All bow down, and thank you, Laura, for that. And what a different world it would be if everybody would bow down. And as the scriptures tell us, there will come a time when every knee shall bow and surrender to God, and it will be a better world. And look forward to that, and appreciate the song that brings that to mind to all of us. As in a sermon that I gave on January the 16th in Portsmouth and on the 23rd of January in Prestonsburg, I talked about a phrase in the scriptures which says, "In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did that was right in his own eyes." And in that sermon, we focused on Judges 17 through 21 and the incidents that illustrated the consequences of there being no king in Israel, and everyone doing that which was right in his own eyes. There literally was no physical king at that time in Israel. It was the time of the judges, but what happened to Israel when they had a king? In time, they had a king. And then as a king was established, was there better government? Did Israel's moral condition improve under a king? Under a monarch, did everyone cease doing that which was right in his own eyes? And were the expectations of the governed met by having a king? So today in this sermon, we're going to examine Israel's demand for a king. We're going to look at God's expectations regarding a king. Prior to that, we're going to look at the consequences of having a physical king. And finally, we're going to look at some lessons we can learn from this particular subject. And so I've entitled this sermon, "There Was a King in Israel." There was a king in Israel. In the sermon that we did in January, we saw in that sermon that there is a cycle that human beings go through. Israel went through it, and human beings still go through it. It is the cycle of sin, servitude, supplication, and salvation. We're in the, unfortunately, sin phase, and we're going to the servitude phase. So, unfortunately, we're not supplicating at this point, but when we are enslaved, we will begin to supplicate to God, and it is when Christ returns and intervenes that we will be saved in the ultimate sense. We also, as we looked at this subject, we saw Israel's deterioration in the area of religion and morality. The degeneration that took place in the home, the degeneration that took place in true religion and in the society. And beyond that, the book of the Judges, did things improve? That brings us to the book of Samuel and a judge by the name of Eli. Let's go to 1 Samuel chapter 2. Did things improve beyond the book of Judges? 1 Samuel chapter 2. Let's begin in verse 12. It says, "Now the sons of Eli were corrupt. They did not know the Lord." So the king was not ruling in their lives. "And the priest's custom with the people was that when any man offered a sacrifice, the priest's servant would come with a three-pronged flesh hook in his hand while the meat was boiling. Then he would thrust it into the pan or kettle or cauldron or pot, and the priest would take for himself all that the flesh hook brought up. So they did in Shiloh to all the Israelites who came there. Also, before they burned the fat, the priest's servant would come and say to the man who sacrificed, 'Give meat for roasting to the priest, for he will take boiled meat from you, but not take boiled meat from you, but raw.' And if the man said to him, 'They should really burn the fat,' 'You need to do the right thing first. Then you may take as much as your heart desires.' He would answer them, 'No, but you must give it now, and if not, I will take it by force.'" Verse 17, "Therefore the sin of the young men was very great before the Lord, for men abhorred the offering of the Lord." They had so polluted the true religion that people didn't want to go up to Shiloh where all of this was taking place. They didn't want to go up there because of how they were being treated in the misuse of the true religion for their own advantage. So people abhorred going up to make sacrifice at Shiloh. You go to chapter 2, verse 22. Now Eli was very old, and he heard everything his sons did to all Israel, and how they lay with the women who assembled at the door of the tabernacle of meeting, to misuse your office as a leader in Israel for sexual favors. So he said to them, "Why do you do such things? For I hear of your evil dealings from all the people. No, my sons, for it is not a good report that I hear. You make the Lord's people transgress." You know, when you have corrupt leadership, the people become corrupt. It's like a little leaven leavens the whole lump. And the people say, well, those scofflaws are doing this or that. And people say, well, if they're doing it, why shouldn't I do it? How many of you have ever come to the conclusion, well, they're doing it, shouldn't I? It's okay if I do it too? We probably all come to that conclusion, haven't we? I'm not asking what, but we've all done it. That's human reason. And that was what was happening in Israel. It says in verse 25, "If one man sins against another, God will judge him. But if a man sins against the Lord, who will intercede for him? Nevertheless, they did not heed the voice of their father, because the Lord desired to kill them." They were warned, but they didn't heed the voice. And they went on doing what they were doing. So in conclusion, what would we conclude when we look at Eli's sons? They were incorrigible, and they didn't administer their priestly responsibilities in the manner commanded by the law. They caused the Israelites to sin, and as we saw earlier, people didn't even want to come up and offer sacrifice. And God sent a prophet to Eli to tell him, you know what? You are not doing what's right. You're not handling this properly. You're not dealing with your sons. And if you don't deal with it, then you're going to be judged, and the judgment is going to be severe. And your descendants will be removed from serving as in the priesthood. And what was God looking for here? Let's go to 2 Samuel chapter 2, verse 35. So God is going to remove the descendants of Eli from the priesthood. And verse 35 says, "Then I will raise up for myself a faithful priest, who shall do according to what is in my heart and in my mind. And I will build him a sure house, and he shall walk before my anointed forever." So he's going to remove that's 1 Samuel chapter 2, verse 35. He's going to put a different priest in that position. And that replacement was not Samuel. It was going to be a different priest, which is, as you go forward in time, the descendants of Eli continue to serve. But during Solomon's reign, the descendant of Eli by the name of Abiathar was removed. He was forced into retirement, and he was replaced by the priest Zadok. And from that point on, the high priest was reckoned through the line of Zadok. In fact, as you go to the book of Ezekiel and you look into the millennial kingdom, you will find the priesthood, the physical priest who will serve, will be related to Zadok. Somehow or other, God can keep track of that, and his descendants will serve in the priesthood. They won't just be descendants of Aaron, they will be descendants of Zadok. So moving forward in the story, let's go to 1 Samuel chapter 4. 1 Samuel chapter 4. And as Israel had developed and had gone along in their land there, they had developed a superstitious approach to God, a superstitious approach to the tabernacle and the ark. And they thought that if they had the tabernacle with them, that automatically, magically, God would help them. Sounds a little bit like the Raiders of the Lost Ark. Hey, if we have the Ark, it's going to give us all this power and might. Well, the movie's fault in that. There is no magical power in that Ark, and it's not the Ark that makes the difference. It's your conduct and God being with you But they didn't get that. They thought, we've got the magic ark, and we bring it out here, and the priest paraded around, and if we have it in our midst, we'll be victorious. And that's not how God operates. And God taught them a lesson about this thinking, because Israel was, they had the ark, that Israel was defeated in battle, and when the report of that defeat was brought to Eli, he died, and the sons of Eli, they were both killed in that battle, and one of Eli's sons, his wife, died as well in the midst of having a child in her grief-induced labor. So with that defeat and the destruction of the capture of the ark and the destruction of the place where they had set up the tabernacle, they abandoned Shiloh, and they never did return there. And Samuel took over all the duties as judge. He is never mentioned in connection with Shiloh. Instead, he returns to his family home in the area of Ramah. And Shiloh's abandonment is further described by the prophet Jeremiah. And let's just turn there and look at one place where that's mentioned, because it is important to remember. Jeremiah chapter 7. You know, we still think magically, human beings do. If I have this icon or I have this object, magically things are going to work out. You know, people still carry rabbit's feet. They still throw salt over their shoulders. I knew some people that still do that. And knock on wood. You know, you have all these kinds of things that people do that are nonsense, but people still do them. And you probably see them. And you know, if you've grown up in a family where it's a common, knock on wood, you know, I've seen people do that even in the church, but they don't even think that is superstitious. It's just how, well, everybody does that, nobody thinks, you know. But it is just superstition. But Jeremiah chapter 7, verse 12, speaks of this defeat. It says in verse 12, "But go now to my place which was in Shiloh, where I set my name at the first, and see what I did to it because of the wickedness of my people Israel." He says, "And now, because you have done all these works, says the Lord, and I spoke to you, rising up early and speaking, but you did not hear, and I called you, but you did not answer. Therefore I will do to the house which is called by my name, in which you trust, and to this place which I give to you and your fathers, as I have done to Shiloh." Just because you dwell in Jerusalem, and just because my temple is there, there's nothing magic about that. And just as I destroyed Shiloh, I can destroy Jerusalem, and I will if you do not have a change of heart. And God eventually did that. And it's a lesson for all of us. We may have started with a biblical foundation as America. And anybody that tries to tell you that there was no biblical foundation don't know what they're talking about. It's a rewriting of history. But just because you had that foundation and you move away from it, you're in the same situation as Israel. So anyway, let's go move on in the story to 1 Samuel chapter 7, where Israel asked for a king. So Eli has died. Samuel has served as judge, and about 20 years later, the Israelites began to seek God again and seek relief from the Philistines. And Samuel gathered everyone together at Mizpah, about 2 miles north of his home in Ramah, and there Samuel led them in pouring out water to God, evidently symbolic of pouring out one's heart in repentance. And the gathering incited the Philistines to attack. But the Israelites were really in a pretty God-oriented frame of mind at that particular time as a result of their turning to God and Samuel's preaching, and God granted them a victory. But as Samuel got older, Israel's faith began to waver again. Samuel's sons were like those of Eli. They weren't righteous. And the people, or at least the elders, worried about what would happen to them when Samuel died. We don't see anybody on the horizon that's going to replace you, Samuel, and your sons are corrupt. What are we going to do? So they decided that what they really needed was a human king, like those ruling and leading the nations around them. You know, as you go back and you look at the, as you, and you know, as we go through this, you need to think about not only what's taking place, but think about its application to us in the here and now. You know, we were founded as a special nation. We were special. England and America were special, the English-speaking peoples. And we've been greatly blessed because of the righteousness of Abraham, not through anything that we have done. And unfortunately, and you know, as we have been blessed, and I was talking to someone before church, and you know, I've lived from 1951 to present, and they've been 50 good years. I mean, I don't have too many complaints. It's not been hard at all compared to some other eras of time. But things are changing, and anciently, Israel's faith began to waver, and they wanted a king. And you know, as you look at our nation, we have wanted a change in rulership. People were fed up with the administration of George Bush and how badly all of that was going, and they wanted something better. Hope and change was what they were offered. So we're now experiencing hope and change. But you wanted a system that is like the rest of the world. And that's what Israel wanted. They didn't see that they actually had the best system possible. And we had the best system possible, you know, humanly speaking. But we've said we don't really want that. Enough people said that, so we're changing. And we'll see how that works out. So God has, you know, the elders of Israel wanted a king. And Samuel began to tell them about this, and God instructed him, tell them about what it's going to be like to have a king. Is it going to be better? So they wanted to be like the nations, and what they were forgetting was that Israel's strength did not come from their ruler. Israel's strength came from God. Israel's strength was to be unlike other nations. They were to be different. They were to be the people of God. The elders, however, were concerned about national security and protection from the enemies around them. And they saw the Philistines, a powerful nation, and the Ammonites were a threat. And Israel had no standing army. Could you imagine living in a world with no standing army? We've never known that. Could you imagine that, saying, okay, if we need an army, we'll put an army together when we need it. But we don't have to have a standing army. We don't have to spend oodles and boodles of time and training and spend money on all of that kind of thing. That's the way it could be, but that's not how it is. And the way it was to be in Israel was when there was a need, the call would go out and men would take up their arms and they would join together and they would take care of the problem. And God would lead them. The elders forgot that it was the Eternal who was Israel's king, who gave them her army and her ability to defeat the enemy. You know, you look at the situation with Gideon. How many people did he have? He has this little tiny group of men, and he ends up defeating a much larger force. Why? I mean, the great thing they did was have jugs and torches and trumpets and... Then God was with them, and they won, didn't they? Those are all important lessons. You may be small, but you can do great things. So what Israel was forgetting was that they already had a king. They had had a king since the founding of the nation back in the time of Moses and the Exodus. The king at that time and for nearly 400 years was the Rock of Israel, the Eternal God himself. In fact, we know him as Jesus Christ. And he was with them in Egypt. He led them out of Egypt. He led them through the wilderness. He led them to the land of promise. And he was with them every step of the way. And through ruling, through his chosen judges from Moses and Joshua all the way to Samuel, God, in the person of Christ, sat on the throne of Israel. He sat on the throne of Israel. Let's look at what it says in Judges chapter 8, verses 22 and 23. Judges chapter 8, verses 22 and 23. And this is back in Gideon's time. Judges 8, verse 22. Then the men of Israel said to Gideon, "Rule over us, both you and your son and your grandson also, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian." "We want you to be a king, Gideon." But Gideon said to them, "I will not rule over you. I will not take that role as king. Nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord, the Eternal, shall rule over you. He is your king." Gideon was flawed as a ruler, but he did recognize at least that much. Samuel later tells the Israelites that the period of the judges was the time when the Lord your God was king, in 1 Samuel chapter 12, verse 12. And it is the reason that when the Israelites told Samuel about their desire for a king, that God said to Samuel, "Look, they've not rejected you. They've rejected me. They've rejected me that I should reign over them." So God says, "Okay, we'll give them a king." An interesting perspective is this, something that I came across as I was studying this subject. As you look in Genesis chapter 49, verse 10, it makes an interesting statement. Genesis chapter 49, verse 10, it's speaking to their Jacob is coming to the end of his life, and he speaks to each of the tribes, and he says in chapter 49, verse 10, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah." The scepter is the symbol of a king. "The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh comes. And to him shall be the obedience of the people." So someone of a Jewish background was always to be king. Now think about that in light of the fact from what tribe was Israel's first king? Was he a Jew? In fact, he was not. He was from the tribe of Benjamin. He was from the tribe of Benjamin. Is it possible that God had a king in mind for Israel, but it was a matter of God's timing? And God had in mind that he would place someone known as David, the son of Jesse, on the throne, but it was not. The time was not ripe for him to be king. So the Lord gave them their request by appointing Saul to be king, and he used Saul to chasten the nation and prepare them for David, the man of his choice. The fact that Saul was from the tribe of Benjamin and not from Judah is evidence enough that he was never expected to establish a dynasty. I mean, if he had acted righteously, God would have allowed his dynasty to go on, but he did not. He makes an interesting point in Hosea chapter 13, verse 11. There it says, "So in my anger I gave you a king, and in my wrath I took him away." So he said, "Okay, you guys want a king? Here you go." And you know, sometimes we get the leaders we deserve. Okay? Was that happening to Israel at that time? You have this king if you had an image of a king, when we in the world tomorrow see Saul, you're going to be impressed with his personal appearance, his physical appearance. He's tall, strong. This guy looks like a king. But you know, a king, if you look like a king, that's really not the issue. It's whether you have the character to be a king. Saul didn't have that character as he displayed in his kingship. And that is the critical factor. So the greatest judgment that God can give us is to let us have our own way. Okay, you really want this? Here you go. And sometimes you get what you want and you're like, "Woo, that didn't go well." So you want what God is going to give you versus what you want. If it's your will, God, that this work out, then please help it to work out. Not my will be done, but your will be done. That's the approach that we want to have. So anyway, the Eternal wanted his people to go into this new venture with a king with their eyes open. So God said, "Okay, we'll give you that." So let's think about the consequences. What's going to happen if you have a king? Let's go to 1 Samuel chapter 8, and we'll look at God spells out what's going to happen when they have a king. You might think of some of these things in regard to our current state of affairs. 1 Samuel chapter 8. And he spells out what happens when you have a king. 1 Samuel chapter 8, verse 11. It says, "And he said, 'This will be the behavior of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them for his own chariots and to be his horsemen, and some will run before his chariots.'" So the king is going to build a standing army, and he will take your sons. And they will be his horsemen, they will run before his chariots, and he will use them in his army. And I happen to be reading a book now called The History of the English People. And I believe it was at the Battle of Verdun. On that one day, there were 54,000 Englishmen killed. 54,000. That's just Englishmen that were killed. Remarkable. A bloodbath. But he will use your men, and he will send them into battle. And they will die in his service. He goes on to say in verse 12, "He will appoint captains over thousands and captains over his fifties, will set some to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and some to make his weapons of war and equipment for his chariots." He's going to put all these people to work in his service. And this is the way it's going to be. And this is the way government has operated. He says, "He will take your daughters." Not only will he take your sons. And, you know, as you think about it, you know, your son going to, you know, we don't believe in going to war. But if your son signs up for the military, I know a minister, his son has chosen to be an officer in the military. What do you do? He's an officer. He's going to serve and he's not in the church. It says he's a free moral agent, but what do you think as a parent? Aren't you worried? You're concerned? Well, he's over where? Afghanistan? Iraq? Those are dangerous situations. But he will not only take your sons, but your daughters to be perfumers, cooks, and bakers. And he will take the best of your fields, your vineyards, and your olive groves, and give them to his servants. You know, as we look at the situation today with taxes, do you get your money first or do they take their taxes first? They take it right off the top, okay? Because they don't trust that you're going to send them that check. And if you end up owing too much at tax time on April 15th, then you're either fined or they expect you to begin paying quarterly. Isn't that right? So they want that money up front. Well, you can't wait till the end of the year? Sorry, we need it now. So anyway, he will take the best of your fields, take that which is first, and give them to his servants. And he will take a tenth of your grain and your vintage and give it to his officers and servants. Wouldn't we all be happy with him taking 10%? Because we're paying a lot more than 10%, trust me. But this is the way it's going to go. It says in verse 18, "And you will cry out in that day because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves, and the Lord will not hear you in that day." So God warns them. God warns them, this is how it's going to be. And he's probably, I'm not sure he's presenting the worst case or the best case, and it's going to get worse from here. So he lays all that out for them, and what do they say? In verse 19, "Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel. And they said, 'No, but we will have a king over us, that we also may be like the nations, that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles.' And God said, 'Okay. Okay, you can have your king. You can have your king.'" And they had a king. Now, God gave them a king, but did God have any expectations of the king? He actually did. Unlike ancient rulers, the king of Israel was not to be an absolute despot. Some of them were, but that's not what they were to be. God has Samuel anoint Saul as commander. It tells us in 1 Samuel 9, verse 16, or captain, as it says in the King James Version, over his people. And the word there for commander or captain is nagid, and it means viceroy. And a viceroy is a vice king. That's what he is. He's not the king. He is a vice king. He is ruling. He's a vassal king to the ultimate ruler, who is God. So the fact that you were, you know, anointed, you were God's anointed, meant that you were under somebody's authority. He was to be under the authority of God. And it's later explained that Israel's king sat on the throne of the Lord, reigning as a king for him. They sat on the throne of the Lord. It's interesting, as also quite different than other kingdoms, was the fact that the king was not a priest over the national religion. He wasn't a priest. He didn't appoint priests. You know, that we could spend a whole, you know, we could go through the kings and look at all of the disasters that happened with the different kings as they didn't follow God's instruction. But they weren't a priest over the national religion. They, in other nations, the kings made the laws, and basically they said, it's yours to do, not me. I'm above the law. But in Israel, God's prophet Samuel explained the rights and duties of the king. And the ruler was subject to the law, as we will see. And essentially the God of creation set up a constitutional limited monarchy in which he would send a prophet as his representative in order to give, you know, basically give the king a report card. He'd go and say, well, you're doing this pretty good, but boy, you're really bombing over here. You're getting F's in these subjects, and you need to correct them. And he would send the prophets to put them on the right track. So God spelled out what he expected of kings in Deuteronomy chapter 17. Deuteronomy chapter 17. He tells them, these are my expectations as far as being a king. And we look at this beginning in verse 14, Deuteronomy 17, verse 14. Here it says, when you come to the land which the Lord your God is giving you, and possess it, and dwell in it, and say, I will set a king over me like all the nations that are around me, you shall surely set a king over you by your choice. Nope. What does it say? You shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses. Would you rather choose them, or would you rather God choose them? See, I can only see the surface, and maybe I can see some fruits, but I don't know for sure. Whereas God, he sees beyond the surface. He sees the heart. And God can see, is this the best person? And that's what I want. God can do a better job choosing than I can. So God said that you want a king whom he chooses. And he goes on to say, one from among your brethren you shall set as king over you. So you're to choose somebody that is part of the family of Israel. He's part of that culture. He's part of that religion. He understands what Israel is all about. He understands that God is the king. He understands their heritage. He understands all of those things. He's part of that. You want a family member to be your ruler. The interesting thing currently in America is the current president is the first non-Israelite to be president. Just something interesting. And in many ways, I don't think he understands the heritage that we have had as a nation. You know, the Constitution is irrelevant, and we need to dispose of it. And you're like, wait a minute, what are you talking about? But that's what we're doing. So you have a different culture, somebody from a different culture and a different background who is ruling and is motivated by different ideas rather than the heritage that we have. And that's just the way it is. And God said things would change on us if we weren't careful. So we want one from among your brethren you shall set as king over you. It says, you may not set a foreigner over you who is not your brother. You're not to have somebody from a different background, a different nation as your ruler. And you think about Ahab. Ahab married somebody from a foreign culture, a Phoenician culture. And how did that work out? He married Jezebel. Did she do the nation any good? Not a bit. So you introduce that in there, and they bring different religion in and a different approach. I mean, she said, look, you're the king. And you know what? If that guy won't sell you his property, then we'll take him out. Under the law of Israel, you couldn't do that. That property belonged to that individual by inheritance, and it was all to always be his family's. But if you're the king from the background of the Phoenicians, you are the king and you can do anything you want. And they did. And that's something that God said, don't introduce that into your nation. Verse 16 says, but he shall not multiply horses for himself. It strictly prohibits your building your army. You shall not multiply horses for yourself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. Egypt was known for their horses, and that's where you would go to get fine quality horses you needed for your army and your chariots. For the Lord has said to you, you shall not return that way again. Don't go down that path. You left that behind. Don't build your army. Because when you begin to build your army, and you have all those chariots and everybody marching before you and the band playing, who are you looking to? Are you looking to God? Look at how great my army is. Look at all these soldiers. They're the best in the world. Don't do that, he said. Don't have confidence in that. Have confidence in me. He says, so that's not the way that they're to go. He goes on to say in verse 17, neither shall he multiply wives for himself. And why not multiply wives for yourself? Hey, I'm the king. I've got the money to support them. And so I can have multiple hot chicks in my as my wives. Well, he said, don't do that, because lest his heart turn away, nor shall he greatly multiply silver and gold to himself. Don't multiply wives. All you have to do is look at Solomon. Solomon did that. How did that work out for him? In time, they led him astray. They influenced him. He loved them. He thought well of them. And, well, can't you do this for me? Can't you do? And he did. And he was compromised. You go on and he says, don't multiply silver and gold for yourself. Don't begin to tax the people and hoard the money. All of that, the multiplication of wives and the multiplication of money, is going to pervert your judgment. It's going to undermine your ability to rule the nation. So God said, don't do these things if you're going to rule. Verse 18, also it shall be when he sits on the throne of his kingdom that he shall write for himself a copy of this law in a book from the one before the priest, the Levites. With his own hand, he was to take and he was to write out every letter of the law. And that law was to be, those five books was to be with him at all times. And why was he to write it? Was he to write it out and then put it on the shelf? No, he was to write it out because it was for him. It was his own personal copy of the law. And you know, you think about it, he was to write out, you know, I'm sure if you start putting it on scrolls, it's going to be much more lengthy than this. But as you think about his guidelines and directions, this portion of the Bible was all that he was to copy. That's it. That was for him. And he gave him all the instruction he needed in order to lead and guide the people and showed him how to live. He goes on to say let's go back to Deuteronomy 17. Lost my place there. In chapter 17, he's to write the book. It says in verse 19, and it shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God and be careful to observe all the words of this law and these statutes. He used to be the guy, the law was to be his foundation, to be his guide. And why was he to look at it every day? Why was he to think about it regularly? As it says in verse 20, that his heart may not be lifted above his brethren. Yes, he was king. He has an administrative office. He is a person who is to rule over the nation, but he is still subject to that law. The law applied to the poorest man in the country, and it applied to the king. It applied to everybody the same. Think about our nation. If you don't pay your taxes, what happens? You're probably going to get a visit from the IRS. And they're probably not going to give you a five years of leeway. They're going to come and get you. And they're going to make you pay that, aren't they? But we have individuals in our own government who don't pay it. So do you think that's spurring people to pay their taxes? I don't think so. If you don't pay them, why should I? Human reasoning. You know, for us as Christians, we may reason that way, but that's not Christian. We're to pay our taxes. It says here, so take all legal exemptions and everything legal, but pay your taxes. So anyway, he was subject to the law just like everybody was, that his heart may not be lifted up, and he begins to think, I'm the king and I'm better than you. Sorry, you're not. So that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right hand or to the left, and that he may prolong his days in the kingdom, he and his children in the midst of Israel. And they would prolong themselves in their office because they lived according to God's law. That's just the way it is. And if you have rulers who do that, what a difference it makes for the country. So, what are some lessons for us since we're not kings? I mean, you say, well, we're not kings, so who cares? There are lessons we can learn from this. Why should we choose a leader who is an Israelite? Well, we would do so because he accepts God as king. And he should understand and be a part of the culture of which we're a part. He understands who we are and where we're from and why we're here. How did this all come about? He's not from a foreign culture which may not know or accept God's way of life. Your king should be your brother. In other words, he should be family. We're not to have reliance upon our power, our money, our looks, our connections, or any other source than God. For a king to rely upon an army, wealth, or alliances instead of God is to move away from the right foundation. A king is told not to multiply wives, and we're to avoid this destructive path as well. Why? Because, as we've seen, Solomon followed that path and eventually began to be influenced by his wives in a direction away from God. And we're not to rely upon our wealth either. You know, you think as you look at what's happening, yesterday the stock market fell 350 points. That's a lot of wealth that's disappearing. Is it going to turn up on Monday? Hard to say. But the thing is, if you're relying on your wealth, it can disappear really fast. Especially if you're invested in the stock market. It can vanish in moments. So the thing is, if we're going to rely on it, and you can call Goldline and load up on gold or whatever, but you know your reliance has to be upon God. Be prudent, make good investments, make wise choices, but when it comes right down to it, you're going to have to rely on God. And frankly, probably more than anything else, what do we need? We probably need one of those barrels like the widow of Zarephath. That barrel that was down to the very bare nubbins. It was over. She is going to make one final cake for herself and her son, and it's gone. And here comes the prophet of God and said, "Hey, can you please feed me?" And basically she was going to make that last cake and die. And so she, I'll make it for you, and she did. And you know what? They had enough to eat through the whole famine. So I'd rather have one of those barrels when it comes right down to it that keeps on producing oil and flour. Now, I have no idea how that works, but it'd be nice to every morning to look in there. Wow, there's a little more flour in there, and there's a little more oil, so we can keep on going. So that's what we need, and that's what we have to rely upon as God to watch out for us. Also, as we think about our lives, the law was to be foundational for the king, and it's foundational for you and me, isn't it? It shows us how to live. It was to be his guide, and it's to be our guide. It was to be his counselor, and to be our counselor. It would keep him humble, and as we measure ourselves by the law, we can't help but be humble, because none of us are perfect. It would keep him from getting off course, and it keeps us from getting off course, and it would bring a blessing to him and his family, and it brings a blessing to us and our families as well. A king would live by, follow, and promote the rule of law, and we would do the same. We would live by it. The bottom line, even when there is a king, it may be that there is no king in Israel. And that is, if the king doesn't recognize the true king and submit to him personally and in his rule over the people of God. And as you examine the most of the kings of Israel and Judah, they didn't submit to God. And the king, the true king, and the results were disastrous. And as you look at our nation now, what's the situation currently? As I was thinking about this and preparing this, I happened to be reading something on the internet, which is quite interesting from the perspective concerning our current national situation. This was written April 12, 2010, by a man named Joseph Farah. And he explains how America fell for the oldest temptation in the book. So I'll just read you this article. It's not overly long. He says, "The only thing we learn from history is that we learn nothing from history." That's a quote from Friedrich Hegel. And Friedrich Hegel, he says, didn't get much right in life, but he was right about that. That the only thing we learn from history is that we learn nothing from history. We go through it, but we don't learn anything. He says, "It is a story as old as the prophet Samuel, before David slew Goliath and before Solomon was a twinkle in Bathsheba's eye. The people wanted change. They wanted to be like all the other nations presided over by a king. They rejected self-government with accountability directly to God. The Israelites pleaded with Samuel, 'Make us a king to judge us like all the other nations.' And Samuel was greatly distressed by this popular uprising, so he asked God about it. Here's what God advised Samuel. He said, 'Hearken unto the voice of the people in all that they say unto you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them.' God recognized that his special, beloved, disobedient, chosen people didn't appreciate what they had. Probably the freest, safest society on the face of the earth, they were envious of other nations that were ruled by a king. So he was inclined to grant them their wish, but before doing so, he issued a warning to the people about what life would be like under the rulership of an earthly king. He would take their sons for his own purposes, making war, working for his government. He would take their daughters to do his bidding. He would take their property and redistribute it as he saw fit. But the people didn't listen. 'Nay, but we will have a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles,' they said, instead of heeding the warning." Do you get the picture? Not only did the people not understand that the king was going to rip them off and oppress them, they actually thought the king was going to fight their battles for them. Does this sound familiar to us today? Just like the children of Israel who didn't know how good they had it, Americans decided they wanted to be like all the other nations, all those nationalized health care programs, command and control economies, the rule of men rather than the rule of law. We fell for one of the oldest temptations in the book, and that's how our current government, that's how we chose our current government. God never wanted us to be ruled by kings, not his people. He wants us to govern ourselves with accountability to him and his laws. And here we are in our current government, subjecting ourselves to the whims of an earthly ruler who doesn't obey the established laws of the land that give him authority, while he scoffs at God's eternal laws as outdated and anachronistic, homophobic, racist vestiges of a paternalistic, chauvinistic, false deity. You know, you have to realize that for you to quote scripture that prohibits homosexuality is considered hate speech. In America today. So you have to realize that you better be careful in your choice of words and which scriptures you quote and where you quote them, because that may be a problem. Just like the children of Israel, we got our collective wish. It was a costly lesson for the children of Israel, and it will be a costly lesson for us. But if we want to learn a lesson from history, we ought to make sure it's the right lesson. It's not about good economic policies. It's not just about following the law of the land. It's not just about the will of the people. It's about being set apart, not about being like the rest of the world. It's about remembering there is one true God in heaven to whom we are all accountable. It's about having no other false gods before us, including the false god of government generally and the false gods of men specifically. You can organize, you can protest, you can sign petitions, you can rally, you can vote, all good things to do, but ultimately there is one real solution, and is found in 2 Chronicles chapter 7, verse 14. 2 Chronicles chapter 7, verse 14. Verse 14 reads, it says, "If my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and will forgive their sin and heal their land." That is the answer to the problems we face as a country. Serious problems. But you know, if we are God's people, you know, physically speaking, descendants of Israel. We are called by the name Israel. And if we will humble ourselves and pray and seek God's face and turn from our wicked ways, then he will hear and he will forgive our sins and he will heal our land. But that's the only answer. It isn't, you know, people think, well, if we vote in some new people in November, it's going to fix it. You didn't fix the problem. You just put new people in. You got to have a change of heart, a humbling before God. So currently, as we look at our nation, we could say that the true king is not in Israel. He's hard to find here. And the fundamental lesson is found in Proverbs chapter 29, verse 2. Proverbs 29, verse 2. It says here, "When the righteous are in authority, the people rejoice." How good it is to have good rulers. But when a wicked man rules, the people groan. You know, when you have bad rulers, you groan. It's a painful process. It's a painful situation. So, you know, we live in a time that's very interesting. And I heard the statement made that we're on the wrong side of history. And I think that statement is true. And that means the good days are behind you. You're not on the upswing, you're on the other side going downhill. And that's a scary thing. And you know, we've talked about how many years people have been in the church, and if you've been in the church as long as some people have, you've heard this, oh yeah, the end is come, the end is near. Well, I think it is near, and things are unfolding to where we're finally going to have a king in Israel. A king who will not only rule Israel, but this whole earth. And as he rules, then the people will rejoice. In the meantime, you and I can learn to rule. And there are lessons that we can learn that Israel never learned. And if we will learn the lesson there of Second Chronicles chapter 7, it will stand us in good stead because we can individually do that. So hopefully this has been enlightening to you about a king in Israel. And there is one more sermon I'm going to give in this regard, which will, I'm not sure when that's going to be, but we'll talk about some New Testament things here and leadership. So hopefully that's been profitable to you. So we'll start the Bible study somewhere around 1:30. So we'll finish up the Garden of Eden, and hopefully you'll find some enlightening things as we finish up that particular subject.